Okay, yeah.
This one, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I asked you those biographical questions.
Right.
In the beginning. Mm-hmm. What is the ethnicity of your family?
We're Hispanic, Mexican American, Chicano. We're born in the U.S. We're not from Mexico, but of Hispanic descent.
How many members are in your immediate family?
I have three brothers. Or my family or my family growing up?
Either one is fine.
Well, my current family is myself, my husband, and my two daughters. And then growing up, I have three brothers, and because my mom and dad are still alive, so.
Were you the youngest?
No, I was a middle child. I had an older brother, a twin brother, and a younger brother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you're a twin?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you guys have any special family traditions?
Actually, we had several, because my grandmother lived with us. And she was also American-born, but she never learned to speak English. Mm-hmm. She lived in Texas, in El Paso, and really never went to school, kind of taught herself to read and write. And so, we had some pretty traditional, you know, Mexican traditions in terms of some of the events. All Souls Day, we would, you know, not to the extent that they do in Mexico, but we'd have some celebrations with that. And, you know, at Christmas, instead of, you know, the Christmas turkey, we'd all make tamales, because that was the tradition.
Okay.
So we'd have Christmas tamales, and it was a big family thing. The family would all get together, and everybody would make them, and then, you know, so it was a whole day thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the types of traditions we had.
This is kind of a general question, but
okay.
Was family very important, like traditions?
Yeah, actually, we were pretty close when we were young. We were close to, you know, all of the family would go to the grandparents for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it wasn't until we got a little older that, my parents and their, you know, brothers and sisters, my aunts and uncles, started holding their own Christmas stuff. But when we were young, we would all go to the grandparents' house, and that's where everybody, all the family would go, cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody. But as we started getting older, we started holding some of our own family events, and we didn't go to the grandparents as much. Yeah, yeah.
So your family grew up in, or is from the United States?
Yeah, they're from the U.S. My father's from Colorado. My mother was born in Los Angeles, and my grandparents were from Texas and New Mexico. So we go back several my maternal side, we go back at least six generations in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And then on the paternal side, we go back two generations. And then the third, my great-grandparents were from Mexico.
Oh, so they immigrated from Mexico?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were there any specific stories about your bakery?
Oh, God, there's a ton of stories. It's funny when you were just asking about whether they emigrated to Mexico. My paternal grandmother was brought to the U.S. as a young child because her father, my great-grandfather, was a landowner in Mexico, in northern Mexico, in Chihuahua. And he was killed at a testimonial dinner given to him by his friends and business associates. And evidently the story is that the family was going to be wiped out, so that word got to my great-grandmother. She bundled up the kids, got in a wagon, and they headed across the border as quickly as they could to avoid being wiped out.
Oh my gosh.
And the family story is that before she did that, she buried their money, their silver, their, you know, whatever, somewhere on the property, and made a map of it that she had. And my father, when he was a young man, a young boy probably about 14 or 15, said he remembers seeing the map, but that his mother was very fearful of any of them going back to Mexico, so she destroyed it.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. And then on my, so that was on the paternal side. On the maternal side, I have my great-great-grandfather was an Apache scout. who was enlisted by, because the Apaches had, there were various tribes of Apaches. There were the Lipan and the White Mountain Apache and the Mescalero and the Chiricahua. And when the U.S. Cavalry was trying to track down Geronimo and Victorio and some of the other leaders of the various Apache tribes, they would hire Apache scouts from the tribes that they were at war with in order to help them. So if they were trying to track down someone from the White Mountain Apache tribe, then they would hire scouts from Apache scouts from the Chiricahua tribe or the Mescal, because they were enemies to begin with. So so we have some stories about that, although you know, our families, both sides, actually were very poor, and so we don't have any real documents. We don't have any, you know, these were all oral histories that were passed on. You know, as our grandparents started getting older, they started talking, and the only reason we found out about the maternal side was because my grandmother, maternal grandmother, got Alzheimer's, was senile, and so she didn't know who we were, but she would talk about the past as if it was the present. So she would, you know, she'd talk about the people in the past, and she'd name names, and she'd talk about the stories as if they were still alive, but she didn't know who we were anymore.
Oh,
so that
wow.
was kind of strange, but it was kind of neat because we got to hear all these things that we'd never heard before, and it was like, wow, I never knew that, you know, so it was kind of neat, actually, but kind of sad that, you know, at that time, because she was already senile, it was difficult to ask questions, you know. I wish I had known enough about that before, so that we could have asked her questions when she was still, you know, a little more cognizant of what was going on. That's how we found out some of the stories.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were born in the United States.
Right. Uh-huh.
And you said here you grew up in East L.A.? You were born in East L.A.?
I was born in East L.A., and then as a child we moved to San Gabriel, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And at that time, it was still pretty wide open. I mean, we still had orange groves. We still had empty fields that, as kids, we played in.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the streets we grew up on, which were still, I mean, well, I'm not that old, but in the city we lived in, ours were some of the last streets that were paved, so they were still dirt roads, dirt streets. And I remember vaguely as a small child walking barefoot in the summer. And you know, walking on the dirt in the street because they hadn't paved them yet. And we had lots of big olive trees along the streets, and all those were removed when they paved, which was really unfortunate. So, and the area I lived in, the city I lived in, there was a community of a few blocks radius that were all Hispanic, you know, Mexican. For the most part, American-born Hispanics, Mexican-American at that time is what they were calling themselves. So our neighborhood was about a block from the railroad tracks, and for the most part we all had older homes. They were, you know, probably built in the 20s and earlier. A lot of them were just wood homes. They were not, you know, the newer stucco homes, and everybody had everybody knew everyone, and everybody had stuff like chickens in the backyard, and I don't know, it was a real sense of community. Everybody knew everybody, and we still have a lot of the old people that were living with their families, a lot more now, grandparents living with, you know, the immediate family. And so everybody had a grandmother or grandfather living at home, you know. And at that time, this was, you know, the 50s and early 60s, a lot of these people were at that time already in their 70s and 80s, but they still dressed very much like the old times. They had, the women had the longer dresses and kind of more like them. There's a type of shoe that's kind of made a comeback now that's kind of a high, it's got a stocky heel and a laced up the front. Kind of like a, not quite a boot, but a lot of the old women used to wear those shoes. And I remember making fun of them at the time, but it's a lot of what the style is now, kind of those laced up boots. Yeah, it was kind of funny. And very religious. A lot of the old women and the old men in our neighborhood, you know, were staunch Catholics and went to church a lot. And, but yeah, it was a real different, it was a real transitional period, because you still had a lot of the people who were born, you know, in the 1800s, late 1800s, who were still alive. And so they brought with them, you know, all of the old ways and the old, you know, the old way of life and approaches to living. So it was kind of an interesting time.
This one is also kind of general.
Sure.
What was your childhood like growing up?
You know, it's kind of interesting because, again, we still had some open fields, and because we lived in a neighborhood, you couldn't go anywhere without someone knowing who you were. You know, you could be, you know, three blocks from home, and someone in the neighborhood would go, "Oh, you're so-and-so's kid," and you were, and they knew exactly who you were.
Wow.
So in a way, it was kind of neat. In a way, at that time, it wasn't, because it was like you couldn't get away with anything because everybody knew who you were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty tight neighborhood. Like I said, it was a, you know, several blocks radius, but we had a lot of mom-and-pop grocery stores, which, you know, most people don't have nowadays. You've got the market.
Mm-hmm.
But we had small mom-and-pop grocery stores kind of all over the neighborhood, and so a lot of people would go there, and that would be kind of a meeting place. We'd run into other kids from other parts of the neighborhood there. A lot of the old men would be sitting outside the stores talking and, you know,
mm-hmm.
visiting. It was a real different, there were these small gathering places. So, like I said, we still had a lot of the old people. And we had, you know, going to school. And then at that time, I remember vividly, we had stuff during the summer. We'd be out there playing baseball.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be out there playing on the street, you know, because it was pretty quiet. We'd be out there until darkness fell, you know, playing hide and seek. And there were a lot of games we played with other neighborhood kids. And I was a real tomboy growing up, so I was always out there with my brothers. And that was tough, because being raised Hispanic, there was a real difference in terms of how you were brought up based on your gender. You know, boys were given more freedom to do certain things, and there were certain roles and ways that women were and girls were expected to be that were different, and it was very much enforced. There were a couple of times when I was the only girl out there with the boys playing baseball, and my mother would call me into the house and wouldn't let me go back out and play because I was the only girl out there. And it just wasn't right that I was the only girl out there playing. Or my brothers were allowed to go, and this is kind of irksome, because I have a twin brother, so we were the exact same age, but he was given and allowed some freedoms that I wasn't, simply because I was a girl. And it was not seemly for me to be out there on the street with the boys. It was not seemly for me to be going and, you know, spending a lot of time playing at other people's houses. That just wasn't right for me as a girl to be doing. I was expected to be, you know, have a very different demeanor than my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And being a Hispanic household, and even though my parents were both born in the U.S., we still had some very strong values that were imparted to us in terms of I was expected to do housework. I was expected to do stuff in the house. And I was raised in a way that my mother and I would be cooking for my brothers and my dad, and we would be the last ones to sit down because they were supposed to be served first because they were male. If I was taught that whenever my father or my brothers, when we got older, came into the house, I was supposed to ask to see if they needed anything. If I was supposed to drop whatever I was doing and ask if they needed something to eat, if they wanted, you know, if they needed anything. My brothers didn't do housework. I mean, I made their beds. It was a real, and what was really funny, I mean, growing up in the 50s, the early 60s, and going to school, I mean, I got a very different sense of what values this society had. So it was always kind of a push and pull, because I would really resent like hell the fact that I would have to drop everything to serve my brothers. I'm going, what? And so I was always at odds with my mother, because my mother was always trying to impart to me the fact that no, you're the girl, you need to do this. And I kept saying, wait a minute, this isn't fair.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a cultural thing, and my grandmother lived with us, and so she was also trying to reinforce those values. And so it was always kind of always a lot of resentment on my part against the fact that I was having to do things that I just didn't consider to be fair, just simply because I was a girl.
Now, were there any other girls in your neighborhood that...
There were just a couple of others, but I really, you know, we really weren't friends. You know, they were far enough away that... Because most of the... It's just funny, most of the families in the neighborhood had boys.
Oh.
It just turned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there were very few girls my age. There were some older that I just didn't, you know, connect with, and there were some younger, but there were very few my age. So it was hard, because it wasn't until, you know, I started going to school and started making friends that, you know, that were my own age, that it was a little easier. But even then, they lived in other parts of the city that I, as a girl, could not go to, because my mother didn't want me going places on my own, you know, because I needed to stay home.
Now, was your school within your neighborhood, or was it in...
No, it's kind of interesting. Our particular neighborhood, and I'm not quite sure how this worked out, because this was in the early 50s, I guess 55, 56 when I started kindergarten. We were bused to a school which was not far from where we lived, but it was on the border of a very, very wealthy neighboring community. So most of the kids that I went to school with, because there were just a handful of us that were, and this was a predominantly white school, and most of the kids lived in the neighborhood surrounding the school, and because it was a very upper middle class neighborhood, most of the kids were coming from parents who were doctors, attorneys, and, you know, real bankers, real professionals. So there was a real difference in class,
mm-hmm.
a real difference. It was very evident, not so much when we were small, but as we started getting older, the differences were very evident. These kids dressed differently. They talked about some of the events, vacations and stuff they took with family. And coming from a poor Hispanic family, I mean, my parents worked, but we just, you know, they were blue-collar workers. They were not educated. We just did, and you know, with poor kids, it was you know, a little tougher. You know, it was really, really different, and it was funny because I remember at a very early age being very cognizant of the fact that there was this different group of people that had a different sense of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did things that I'd never heard of. You know, there were organizations that their families belonged to that I'd never heard of. There was a very, very distinctive class difference, and all the teachers at the school were Anglo, and at that time the majority were female. We didn't have as many male teachers then, as I recall. And I remember some of the teachers making comments, or, you know, a lot of facial and body language when it came to dealing with us. There was still a lot of discrimination going on. And as a little kid, you know, you pick up on it without even realizing that you do. And even to this day, I find it very difficult to explain to someone who hasn't experienced it, that you can pick up just in a facial expression,
mm-hmm.
or the body movement or something, the fact that these people don't like dealing with you because of who, you know, of who you are. And there was a lot of that when I was growing up as a kid, not just at school, but in other contexts, in other areas, just in the community.
So was your school a Catholic school?
No, it was a public school, just a regular public school.
So there was no uniform?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. So we, like I said, there were some very, very distinct class differences. Well, I remember this vividly. You know, you hit school and you start having birthday parties. Well, I never had a birthday party. I had my first birthday party at 18, I think, because we just couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just didn't have the money to be throwing a birthday party for little kids. And now, of course, I did it with my kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the time they hit school and started making, and even before. But, and I remember being, you know, feeling bad because I'd be invited to parties, but I never had one of my own to invite friends to. And I remember asking to do it, and I very vaguely remember my mother saying no. So there were those types of, you know, they could be considered minor things, but at the time when you were a little kid, they're big things,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or you hear these kids talking about all the stuff they got at Christmas, and, you know, you got maybe an article of clothing and, you know, one toy, and they're going on and on with it. Listen, I got this, and I got this, and I got this, and you're going, wait a minute. I got one thing, you know, a new dress and a, you know, something else. So, yeah, there was, but my parents, you know, tried. It's just, they were struggling, you know, and again, at that time, without having the educational back, so much money, even my dad worked multiple jobs, it was hard.
Yeah.
was tough.
Was your high school connected to?
High school was also predominantly white, upper middle class, some of these same kids. There were more Hispanics, but again, we were in the minority. And even though by then, you know, we were more kind of assimilated into the culture. I mean, my parents valued education, and they were always very staunch supporters of our doing well in school. So, you know, we never got a sense that education was not important. In fact, they said, no, you will be educated. But there were still class distinctions. I mean, there are cliques in high school anyway,
mm-hmm.
but there were also class distinctions. One of the things that became evident in high school also, but that as we were getting ready to, because I always wanted to go to college. And in fact, when I was in junior high, and the high school counselors came to our campus to help us, to help the eighth graders put their program together to enroll, you know, for freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
I was a really good student in school, and I got A's. But this counselor sat me down, and because I was Hispanic, said, well, these are the classes that you should be enrolling in, and he was pointing out typing, business, business practices, accounting, and I remember looking at him, because, and then he explained to me that way, when I graduated from high school, I could get a job as a secretary. And I remember looking at him, I'm saying, and I kind of started shaking my head, and I said, no, I want college prep courses, I want algebra and English, because I want to go to college. And he gave me this kind of a smirk, like, yeah, right, you know, kind of thing. He says, no, you really should be taking these other, and I said, no, I don't want those courses. I want algebra, I want English, you know, all the college prep courses. I had to argue with him, and he finally gave in and let me enroll in those courses. But because I was Hispanic, he made the assumption that the best I could do was to get a job as a secretary. So that really angered me. And because of that, this is a funny side note, I never learned how to type. I refused to learn how to type because I refused to be pigeonholed into that secretary designation. Even to this day, I do a pretty fast one-finger typing because I just refused. I said, I will not do that. So even as recently as that, going into high school, we were still running into a lot of the discrimination just based solely on the fact that we were, you know, Hispanic, and we were poor kids, you know, from the other side of the tracks, because we did have railroad tracks that kind of bisected the city. So it was kind of interesting. But yeah, high school was better. I was very heavily into athletics, and so that was kind of nice. Spent a lot of time with that. But again, most of my friends were also Hispanic, you know, some of the other girls and guys who were in sports. So our group, even though we had a couple of other kids in there, were for the most part, it was a Hispanic group of people and kids that we hung out with and did stuff.
Are there any kind of like clubs on campus?
Oh yeah, yeah. Just the typical high school clubs, you know. At that time, there were everything. I mean, there were the athletic clubs, and there were the Spanish clubs, French club, you know, all the regular clubs. I was a member of some of the clubs and did get involved to a small extent with the campus government, you
mm-hmm.
know. But one of the things that we didn't have, and I think, and I don't know if it's still the case, I saw a little bit when my kids were in high school. Our counselors were not real available. We didn't have a lot of counseling that was done. And for those of us who had never been to college, I'm thinking more like junior, senior year, I didn't know what questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody had ever been to college in my family, so I didn't know what questions to ask about. You know, I knew I needed to apply to college, and, you know, I try and ask some questions, but I know that I didn't get a lot of information because I didn't know what to ask. And in that regard, I wish they'd done a little better job, because I think I would have tried some different things. I had really good grades, and I think I could have gone to some better schools and maybe with scholarships and stuff, but I didn't know enough to be able to figure that out and do it. So the fact that I was even going to college was a big deal. I mean, that was like, man, just to be able to do that was a big deal. And I chose the state college because that's all I could afford, because I was going to be working my way through college.
Okay. Did your brother go to college as well?
My older brother, later, at that time, my twin brother didn't, and my older brother, was going to, and then this was during Vietnam, and so he ended up going to Vietnam. And so he didn't finish college until after he got back. So I was basically the first one going.
Oh, and was your father and mother the more dominant parent in the family?
They, you know, my father wasn't in charge of the family, but my mother and he actually had a pretty good relationship. I mean, they, you know, they were both very strong individuals, and so, you know, when my dad, you know, because my dad worked a lot, so my mother was in charge a lot. Mm-hmm. But my dad was, you know, they were in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very, they were strict disciplinarians with us. You know, they didn't let us get away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And because we lived in that neighborhood, damn it, they knew everything that we would, you know, that we were trying to do. So, it was pretty much your traditional, probably maybe a little less traditional Hispanic in that he was not the ultimate authority. My mother was also an authority with us.
Now, did your parents both work, or was it just your dad?
My dad predominantly. My mother now and then would work for a while, for a number of months. But not until we were a little older.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, she was a stay-at-home mom, and my dad was a little working.
I hear that you went to Cal State LA.
Uh-huh.
And what did you graduate?
What year did I graduate?
Well, I mean,
I went to Cal State LA, and that first year was really tough because I felt totally lost. There were no mentoring programs. There was no orientation. I just went to school. I just started the first day of school not knowing a soul on that campus. And it was really a kind of a hit and miss thing because some of the courses were large, you know, large classrooms. And there were days when I didn't talk to anybody all day. I mean, I went to school and then I went to work because I was working.
Mm-hmm.
So when I wasn't at school or studying, I was at work, working. And so I didn't do activities or anything because I had to leave to go to work. So there was no real good way, there was no transition, you know, nothing that explained what to expect. I didn't know what to expect. And then going from having gone to through school with predominantly female teachers, now all of a sudden most of my teachers were male. And that was real different. It was like, whoa. And because I had been raised, you know, in our culture where we respected older people and we didn't question them and we didn't argue with them. I mean, that was a big no-no. You don't argue with your elders. So it was kind of, and here was these professors who were, you know, at that time, they were older, they were male, and they were considered, you know, I was supposed to respect them because they were professors, you know, they were. So there were times when, you know, I was really struggling because I felt like I was out of my element. And I knew, and this is kind of funny, because here we go back to the class thing. I knew there were things going on in this college that I knew nothing about. But I couldn't figure out how to find out what that was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew there were students in my classes, and it was very obvious because they were very comfortable with themselves, and they would argue with the professor, or they'd have these discussions. And I remember thinking, okay, they must know something that I don't know. Because otherwise, why would they feel so comfortable doing this? So there were a lot of things that I recognized I didn't know, but there was nobody for me to ask. At least I didn't think so, because I didn't feel comfortable talking to the professors, you know, and I didn't know enough students at that time to be able to figure that out. So after the first year, I struggled very, very hard. I stopped. I decided not to go to school for a year and just work full time and save money so I could go back to school full time, because I was getting to the point where I was going to have to make some more money. And it was probably the thing that saved me, taking that year off, because I think if I had continued, I probably would have done really badly and dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
But I was determined that I, you know, and it's funny because somebody had asked me years ago, well, didn't you have a mentor that was kind of helping you? And I said, no. And I said, well, why did you keep going? I said, you know, I think I was just so pissed over the years that people telling me I couldn't do this and I couldn't do that, and you know, you're only a girl, and no, you can't, you know, you're not supposed to do that, and why are you wasting your time going to college? that I was just angry, and I wanted to do this, and I was going to do it because everybody was telling me I shouldn't do it. So I stopped for a year and then went back to school, and then again continued, you know, working and going to school. And so it took me a while. It took me longer than 4 years. I think it took me about 5.5 years.
And you went to Cal Poly.
Well, then I went to work and started having kids, and it wasn't until just recently in the last few years that, now that my kids were grown and stuff, that I came back to school, because the jobs I had, my intent, actually I started a master's program, but then I decided I wanted to have kids before I was 30, and by then I was married, and so then I had my children, and then I went to work, and the jobs I had didn't allow time for me to go back to school. I was working, the jobs I had, I mentioned I had political jobs, I worked for elected officials, I was a legislative person for a labor union for a number of years, and so these were not 8-to-5 jobs. I was working long hours, weekends, nights, and I just didn't have, the schedules didn't allow me to go back to school. So it wasn't until recently that I finally went back and got and did the master's.
Now, did you meet your husband at?
At Cal State. He's a Vietnam vet. He was back. He was going, and then going to school on the GI Bill.
How long have you guys been married?
27 years.
I've been with the same as my parents.
Yeah.
So you worked for elected officials? What kind of?
Yeah, what's really funny is back in 1968, when I was still in high school, I volunteered to work on Bobby Kennedy's campaign just as an envelope stuffer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course then he was killed, and that was just devastating, but I kind of got a taste for it being, I was always very interested, and of course during the 60s, the civil rights, you know, I was growing up when the civil rights movement began and when all the student protests were going on, because we had it at our high school as well, and the United Farm Workers were, raising issues, and so, but that was the first time I had actually volunteered, and so after that, it kind of just led to volunteering for some other local elections, and then I kind of hooked up with the United Farm Workers and started, while I was in college, and started doing some volunteer work for them. And this is, we were trying to pass some propositions and working with the state and stuff. So I met Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, and I mean, they were in and out of the headquarters all the time. And then when I got older, when I was having my children, I kind of backed off a little bit, but I still kind of had a foot in the door with local Democratic politics. And worked on some local campaigns, like for the county and the state, people who were running for office. And again, strictly on a volunteer basis, just kind of. And then it was after my second daughter was born that I really kind of got into it heavily, and started doing some legislative work. And for this, what happened was I ran a slate of officers for this labor union group, and they won. And so then they asked me to be their kind of a legislative analyst. And so I started doing that and kind of lobbying in Sacramento and on legislation dealing with if the industry they were in was the telecommunications industry. There was a lot going on then. So I would do analysis, and then I'd share it with them, and then I would go to Sacramento and we'd lobby. Doing that, when I was introduced to a man who was going to be running for Congress, and he was looking for union support. And so we gave it, and I started working the campaign for him from the union local, and he won.
Wow.
And so when he won, he offered me a position with him, working as one of his field deputies. I did that for a number of years, and that was real interesting. But again, those jobs meant that I could have a early breakfast morning at 7:30 in the morning, and then have a full day of meetings, and then have evening meetings. So there were times when I'd be out the door at 7 in the morning and getting home at midnight that day.
Mm-hmm.
And weekends, because he was in Congress, he may be in Congress all week long, and then he'd take the red eye, the midnight flight from Washington, D.C. to the district office, land Friday, and then have Saturday, Sunday full of activities, and we were always with him. One of us was always with him. So even though we would rotate, there were just a couple of us that were senior staff, so we would be with him, briefing him as we were taking him from event to event, or from meeting to meeting. So there were many times when not only would I be working long hours during the week, then I'd be working all weekend too while he was there. So it got to the point where I mean, my kids were young, and I was gone a lot, because then I will also fly back to D.C. quite often,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do stuff back there. So after a few years, you know, my husband and I started talking. I said, you know, I love this work. I mean, it's, you know, I really want to do this, but I'm gone all the time, and I you know, I don't see the kids. So we've been talking about leaving L.A. anyway. And so we said, you know, if we're gonna leave LA, we need to do it when the kids are small. And so one day we said, that's it, we're leaving. We put the house up on the market because we owned our home. And as soon as the house sold, we quit our jobs and we moved up to the Central Coast. And that's how we ended up here.
Mm-hmm.
But then I said, okay, that's it. I'm just gonna find an 8-to-5 job. So I did find that, and I worked, actually it was here at Cal Poly, but I was doing something different. And I was working at Cal Poly, and then I got a call one day from a woman who had just won her election as one of the newly elected county, Santa Barbara County supervisors. And she was looking for someone to be her chief deputy. And my name had been given to her. And I thought, oh, no, I don't want to do this again because it's long hours.
Mm-hmm.
But she was starting up, it was a new district because they go through redistricting every 10 years after they do the census.
Okay.
They redistrict, they redraw the boundaries on the various elected districts. And so she said, well, I know that you had worked with the congressman and that you guys basically started from scratch in a new district. I said, oh yeah, I remember that day. The first day, he was back in D.C. being sworn in, and I was in the district office with no furniture, a telephone, a pad of paper, and a pencil sitting on the floor. I mean, that's how we opened up our office. So she said, well, maybe we could meet and you can just give me some pointers on what to do to set up a new office. And I said, okay. Well, we met and we just hit it off, and she really, really wanted me to go work for her site. So I went back and I did that for 4 more years. I worked for her. And again, it was the same thing. Lots of meetings, you know, lots of issues that were coming up. And after 4 years, I said, okay, that's it. I need to go back to some sort of, you know, Monday through Friday, 8-to-5 job. Because my kids were growing, but still, they needed me. I mean, they were, and I started thinking about the fact that before long, they were going to be gone. So then I came to work for Cal Poly, and I've been here since.
Now, when you worked for that
congressman or the supervisor?
The supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Was her office based in Santa Barbara? Did you have to travel back and forth?
Yes. Her office, actually, she had an office in Santa Barbara City as well as in Lompoc because her district was so large. We have two offices.
Oh, okay.
And so many times while she was at meetings in Santa Barbara, I was meeting, you know, the office in Lompoc and meeting. It involves everything. You know, that's at the county level, but when you think of all the different county things, the county offices, everything from flood control to roads being paved to, you know, riverbeds being cleaned to agricultural issues to county probation issues to court issue. I mean, there's such a gamut of the same thing at the federal level. Working for Congress, you're dealing with immigration issues, you're dealing with the Social Security Administration, you're dealing with environmental issues because you've got EPA, you're dealing with oh my goodness, I can't even think. Military issues, because all the military is federal. I mean, there's a lot of different things you're dealing with all the time, so it's never a dull moment because you don't know from one day to the next how many different things you're going to be dealing with. 1 minute, and have the consulate in the Philippines the next minute, and have somebody back in D.C. in the Department of Labor the next minute. It's just, you know, real quick things are happening all the time.
Now, when you work for the congressman, does that allow you to travel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, although most of my traveling, we would hold hearings, sometimes congressional hearings in other areas, but most of my travel really was back to D.C.,
mm-hmm.
back to Washington. He had offered me the choice of working either back in Washington or the district, but at the time I didn't want to uproot the kids and get it, you know, and I can't handle back east winters.
Yeah.
It's just too cold. It's just, I said, no, I'll stay in the district. But I'd fly there quite often. Probably I've done more traveling all over the country in the job I have now because of professional conferences and meetings and stuff.
Mm-hmm. You say you've been working for Cal Poly for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is retirement in
Oh, yeah. I'll retire from here. Although I'm going to retire fairly soon. I mean, not immediately, but in a few years. And then I want to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like this is the only career I have. I feel like there's other stuff I can do out there. And that's kind of how it's been. It's been things that I've done have kind of led from one thing to the other. I never wanted to work in politics. I was an anthropology major. I wanted to be an archaeologist. That was my goal.
Wow.
I swore I would never work in an office, that I was going to be an archaeologist working out in the field. And then I volunteered in political campaigns, and then it kind of took off from there. The opportunities I've had have come as a result of the political stuff. You know, you meet people, you network, and they know who you are, and they know the kind of work you do, and then they offer. Really, this is the only job I've really had to look for. You know, once I left the Santa Barbara County, I knew I had to find another job, and you know, this one, I you know, the others have come by means of being asked. You know.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any like hopes for when you do retire, like doing the travel or?
You know what I want to do, and it seems like a pretty minor. But yeah, travel is one thing. I actually want to do more work on my beating stuff. Cause, what I want to do, I want to start doing more volunteer work. I want to do the literacy council and teach adults how to read. Because I've always felt that there are a lot of programs, I think, especially in the schools for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it's harder for adults who have never learned to read to, you know, to seek help. And I just think, what a neat thing to be able to teach someone, you know,
mm-hmm.
how to read, because that will open up
so
many doors and this whole new, you know, vista for them. So that's, I want to do some more volunteer stuff. In addition to doing whatever else I'm doing, whatever that turns out to be. I still feel like I think it's really different now, because I look back on people, you know, by the time they hit their 50s and stuff, you know, they're looking at retirement. But I think we've got a whole different generation of people,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I said, people your mom's, your parents' age. You know, we're the baby boomers, and so we're not ready to call it quits. You know, we're not ready to go, oh yeah, I'll retire at 55 or 60 and then just sit back and do nothing. I don't think that's going to happen. Well, most of us are looking for doing other things, other careers, or heading off in other directions. So I'm kind of excited about the next phase, whatever it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to be, but kind of do something. Because, you know, you're only as old as you think you are. As old as you feel.
I had just one question.
Sure.
About the,
go ahead.
Something about Social Security. Like, does it worry you that there might not?
You know, it does, because there's so many of us. There's so many baby boomers. And of course, given the fact that there's been talk over the years, and given the fact that they have, as recently as last year, tapped into part of that Social Security. It's worrisome, because I think for a lot of people that haven't had, for whatever reasons, that haven't had the kind of careers or lives in their jobs that they would have liked, they're going to have to rely heavily on Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Others who have had, who have had better opportunities and have had careers and have been able to invest. Not everybody is the same. And you know, and thinking about some of the kids I went to school with who never made it out of high school. It's really hard coming from, especially if you're disenfranchised, if you don't feel you're part of the society, if you don't, you know, you don't feel like you're going to make it, that what's being offered out there for other people isn't available to you, so you stop trying. These are the people that become marginalized, the ones who turn to living on the fringe.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of that in my neighborhood. There was a lot of that in some of the kids I went to school with. They just never got... For a number of reasons, you know, part of it was cultural, part of it was socioeconomic. A lot of it had to do with the norms at the time, the values at the time. It was a different time growing up in the 50s and early 60s. It's not like it is now, where, you know, kids are encouraged to, you know, to seek what they want to do, and I think there's a lot more programs now to help students realize, you know, and to figure out what they want to do and to realize their potential. And that just wasn't the case for a lot of kids my age, you know, at that time. And a lot of them dropped out, and a lot of them didn't go on. Some of them were very bright kids,
mm-hmm.
but they were made to feel less than bright in the schools they were in. Maybe they didn't quite catch on. Maybe they were slower at some things, and so they fell further and further behind, and there really weren't a lot of efforts to help them. That was before they had any kind of diagnosis for ADA or anything like that. So there were, thinking back on some of the kids I went to school with, I remember some kids that I think had ADA, or who were just a little slow and needed some special attention but probably could have made it. They didn't. They dropped further and further behind and then they dropped out. And then if you drop out and you don't have an education, you can't get good jobs. So you're working, then your jobs are working on the fringe. And there's a lot of people in that situation. And that's why I think Social Security is so important, because some of these people, they've only had blue-collar jobs. They've only worked as waitresses or for whatever reason. And they're going to need something more because they just don't have the wherewithal to retire. And having seen what I saw growing up, I can't just say, well, everybody's got the same opportunity to reach the top. Well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. They don't. And people can kid themselves about that, but it's not true. There's a lot of racism that still goes on that's very subtle. It's not as overt as it used to be. Some of it is very subtle, but still goes on. You see it, you can still feel it. It's still out there. Mm-hmm.
You were talking about your bead making. Is that a...
Yeah. Well, I've always been interested in it. Funny, because I was always interested in it. And then, about when the kids were kind of getting older, I started reading some stuff started reading stuff on Apaches, because I wanted to find out more. I wanted to find out, okay, what tribe was he from? What tribe was my great-grandfather from? Or great-great-grandfather from, and what area, because I knew what area they lived in the 1800s, and so I was trying to look at the maps of the various Apache tribes, thinking, okay, if he was here at this time, if it was the 1870s, what tribes were in that area at that time, you know? And so the more stuff reading I started doing, I also started attending some powwows, you know, some of the Indian powwows, just to kind of get a sense of, you know, actually I was looking to see if they had any kind of genealogical stuff that I could buy or look at. And so then I've always been interested in the beadwork. And so one day I just decided to teach myself how to bead. So I got books, and I bought one of those little toy looms, you know, the looms you can buy at the hobby store, and figured it out. And what was very interesting is that most of the how-to books are for right-handed people, and I'm left-handed, so I had to reverse everything. So I could learn how to do it. So I would hold the book up to the mirror and I'd go, okay, that's how, because it was hard to go, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense for me. And then, you know, I started getting more proficient at it, and then a friend started doing it with me, and then the two of us started going to powwows, and then I took one class years ago from a Navajo woman on a weekend.